She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And my advice would be today for this show, fasten your seatbelts, because we are going to give you lots to think about. Thanks for joining us. We greatly appreciate the support of our sponsors, as you know, and a special thanks today to the sponsor of this show, Goodwill Industries of Southern Arizona. Their mission is to provide services, training, and jobs to people with barriers to employment. And they are literally rocking it all over the country. Resale is very in right now. So when you are thinking of getting rid of your good stuff, think about donating it to Goodwill, because the resale is what supports their programs for people that really do have barriers to employment. Thank you, Goodwill Industries of Southern Arizona. So I'm going to take a deep breath. People remind me to breathe all the time, and I say there's pretty much no time for that because we've got a lot of things to do. But I'm very excited about our show today for many reasons. First and foremost is the return of a very special guest, Osprey Lake. And I will give her a proper introduction in just a minute. But first, there's something that I want to share with everybody. It's the first time on the airwaves, and we are very excited about it in Mrs. Green's World. We're launching our very first Kickstarter campaign today. And the name of the campaign is What Am I Eating and Why Should I Care? And the basic mantra is all connected to Osprey being on the show, because it really all starts with your fork. It's a very important venture for us. We hope you'll check it out at MrsGreensWorld.com/Kickstarter and be a part of our journey to learn about why healthy eating and everything you eat has an impact on you, your health, and the health of your planet. If it is to be, it's up to me. And we can start preserving the planet by eating healthier and cutting down on packaging, and the beat goes on. So we hope you'll help us spread the word. And Osprey, how perfect is it that you're the guest on the show and we launched Kickstarter today? There's something very serendipitous about that to me.
Oh, thank you. I think so, too. Thank you for having me on your show, and good luck with your campaign.
Thanks. And let me give you the proper introduction. And I'm prone to hyperbole anyway, but in this case, not necessary. Osprey Lake is an author. She's an artist. She is a thought leader and a truly lifelong advocate of social environmental justice issues. She's the founder and president of the Women's Earth and Climate Caucus and is the co-chair of International Advocacy for Global Alliance for the Rights of Nature. And if that's not enough, she's spearheading another international art project, which we'll probably have to bring her back for another show, the International Kima Monument Project, which is so intriguing and captivating and planet-altering, and it's about the placement of large brown monuments in very public places around the world to inspire building bridges between cultures. So, Osprey, welcome, and so happy to have you join me today and be back on our show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you again.
So let's talk about the Women Earth and Climate Caucus, because there's a caucus and there was a summit, which, you know, we talked a little bit off air. Life-changing for me. Everybody in Mrs. Green's World knows that I was there. Start with that dream and how you gathered what I would call the A-list of women global leaders. It's not like there's a B-list, but you had really important global leaders like Jane Goodall and Vandana Shiva help build a vision about the planet and climate action. So you get to talk for the rest of the show.
Thank you so much, and I'm really glad that you could be with us at such an important time. So I think one of the most important untold stories of climate change that we're really experiencing right now actually has to do with women's leadership and women's empowerment. which is really the focus of the Women's Earth and Climate Caucus. And many studies show us that women are the most negatively impacted by climate change, yet they're really key to solutions, and that's why we really started what we're now calling the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network, which is a project of the Women's Earth and Climate Caucus, and it's really an offshoot of this international summit that we held in September just of last year. And, you know, what I found, having done a lot of my own research on women's role in sustainability, is just remarkable projects and campaigns and ideas and on-the-ground, boots-on-the-ground work that women are doing. And I began to have this vision of bringing women from all over the world together from many different sectors to create really a holistic approach to climate change solutions. And it's something I think women are really well suited for, is looking at the whole picture and seeing how it's connected and how we can support each other. And I kind of view it like an ecosystem where people are doing different things and different parts of the ecosystem are engaged in different activities, but together it creates a healthy system and a healthy place for us to live, for communities live, to nature to survive. So we invited business women, scientists, policymakers, indigenous and grassroots leaders, all coming from these different entry points, but really unified in common cause around climate change. And as you mentioned, we had, you know, so many remarkable women, you know, some that are very well known, like, as you mentioned, Dr. Jane Goodall, Dr. Vandana Shiva. We had Dr. Sylvia Earle on oceans. We had the Secretariat of the United Nations Climate Negotiations, Cristiana Figueiredo there, Marina Silva from Brazil. We had former President of Ireland, Mary Robinson, there, who's been a real fighter for women and climate justice. And then, you know, a lot of women who might not be names that we know so well, but, you know, they're equally important and have very large constituencies. Indigenous women like Patricia Gualinga, who's a Sariaca leader from Ecuador. We had Nima Namandu from the Congo forests, leaders from the Brazil. We had women flying in from the Philippines, from the Maldives Islands.
Australia, so, 1 million women, that movement in Australia.
Yes, we had a woman from Australia. Her name is Natalie Isaacs, from a wonderful organization in Australia called 1 Million Women, that are dedicated to reducing their carbon emissions from looking at women in their home circle and what they can do there. So it was just, as you say, it was just an extraordinary room full of women. And I think the balance of women from the Global South and the Global North, making sure we had a lot of indigenous women there so we could really see what frontline communities are experiencing, the impacts, the solutions, and hold together these amazing plenary sessions. But also we had many working groups, and the two outcome documents, one is complete and one we're in the process of completing, have been extremely valuable, because obviously we didn't want to just meet and then that was the end of it. It was really important to build a network and have an action plan. So one of the documents that we came up with is the Women's We Can Climate Declaration, and people can go ahead and see that online. Our website is www.wecaninternational.org, and you can see the declaration there. People from all over the world are signing it, and in a little bit I'll tell you about a big action we're having on February 14th where people all over the world are going to be signing that declaration. And then the second document that people had working groups about, eight different working groups, is called the Women's Climate Action Agenda. And it's a very detailed analysis of how we really can win, so to speak, this climate fight. And it's everything from policy decisions that need to be made to on-the-ground solutions, because we really, our theory of change is that you've really got to go at every level. You've got to hit it at the policy level, but you also really need people on the ground who are activating solutions, and those two things need to come together. So we're very excited about the Women's Climate Action Agenda, and it's going to be made public in about a month. And it's been a very exciting process to engage so many experts, women in many different fields, to contribute to this process, to comment on oceans and water and food sovereignty and indigenous rights and everything from putting a price on carbon to financial transaction tax. All these different solutions, rights of nature, are included in this document. So I think people find it very dynamic and really interesting. And the whole the whole effort of the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network and the documents we came up with are based on our guiding principles, which we feel provide, you know, sort of the missing pieces that have brought us out of balance. So the four guiding principles are rights of women, rights of indigenous peoples, rights of nature, and rights of future generations. And so you'll see that foundation really being expressed in all of the work that we're doing. So we're very excited about really creating this global women's climate action network that even since the summit has been quite active. So I'll give you back the talking stick that kind of gives you a sense of where we've been and a little bit about where we're going.
But I love that. Give me back the talking stick, because what I am doing is going down the rabbit hole of listening, which is exactly what happened to me when I was at the summit. I love to talk, but I also love to listen. And when I was there, I don't think I've ever been so quiet for such a long period of time, maybe since I was born. I want to ask you about what you're capable of doing, you as a person and on the website, and the message of the summit is to really present a sense of urgency without panic and still give us hope. Because there are days when I could go to the dark side if I read about something. You know, fracking is a good one to send me down to a very dark place. And when I read more about Monsanto, there was a sense at this summit of very clear urgency, as I said, without panic and with lots of hope. So can you talk about that just a little bit?
Sure. I think I'll begin by talking about first understanding where some of the groundedness that you experience come from, and a lot of the women who are engaged in our network. I think it's important to understand that women are central stakeholders with power in a lot of these situations around fracking and around food security and food sovereignty, around our water issues. So as an example, between 60 and 80% of all household food production in developing countries is done by women.
Right.
So when we're talking about really boots on the ground, what are we going to do about protecting our food shed, we're talking about women. This is also true about water. A lot of programs around the world that want to ensure that communities have water, especially in developing countries. UN studies and others show if you don't include women in these solutions, they don't work, because women know where the water is. They're collecting the water on a daily basis, caring for their families. So women have a lot of power there. We know that when women are in parliamentary positions around the world, they're much more progressive in their decisions about environmental legislation. 80% of all consumer purchases in North America are decided by women.
Right.
So a lot of our work is really looking at what women can do with their purchasing power and also demanding an end to fossil fuels and transitioning to clean energy. So we could go on, and people can look at the website about a lot of the different stats around incredible power women have. So one of the things that we were doing at the summit, and we continue to do in all of our work, is to bring attention to women about the power that's in our hands when we work collectively. And so these stats are not just numbers. They're really a way of informing and educating women about what we're already doing and making it much more visible, so women say, wait a minute, you know, there's actually a lot I can do in my community, and women are already doing, which encourages us, of course, to do more.
And it's the sense of, like, I am not alone.
Yes,
and
exactly.
It's a perfect segue to, and finish your thought. I mean, it's always a conversation with you and I, but the magnitude of the seeds planted manifested itself very clearly to me on last week's show with Layla from Amazon Watch, when she talked about Patricia, and you mentioned that, but one of your core pillars is the rights of indigenous people. So what Layla said is the seeds for this entire action of the gathering of women of the indigenous people about the dam in Ecuador, I believe I'm getting that right, is the seeds were planted at the summit. So can you speak to that a little bit? Because you just got back. It's like hot off the press.
Sure. Patricia Gualinga is a really amazing leader from the Sarayaco people in Ecuador. And what they're fighting is actually oil extraction.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
In their territories. And it's a very, very serious situation. And so Patricia, you know, having come out of the Women's Summit, was just very, very encouraged to see the impact of women standing together in solidarity for what they believe in. And she then went back to Ecuador and mobilized women to have a march, to march from their territories to Quito, the capital of Ecuador, to protest against that they would listen to them about not oil, not having oil extraction in their territories. So there's been a lot of incredible movement by women coming out of the summit, again, in many different sectors. And I guess I'll just segue into something that's immediately coming up, which is that right after the summit, we met with Eve Ensler, who you probably know is the leader of the 1 Billion Rising campaign, the V-Day action, which is really focused on women and violence and visibilizing the terrible problems with women and violence all over the world. And last year they put on, you know, the largest international action that the world has ever seen, with women getting out and doing actions for women and violence. This year they are changing the campaign slightly, and it's on justice, different themes about justice, because in their own analysis they began to realize, you know, justice, you know, violence against women comes out of many different sectors. And so when we met with Eve, we decided to do from the Women's Earth and Climate Caucus an action on women and climate justice. So we're actually getting ready for that. It's coming up, you know, these next weeks. And we're organizing our network, you know, from Morocco to Bolivia to Congo, Brazil, all over the world. We're bringing our network together to have actions between February 1st and February 14th demonstrating women and climate justice. And it will be everything from showing, like, Patsisi Gualinga's fight and struggle and her resistance movements with other women in Ecuador to protect their lands and way of life, to one of our other members, Colleen Ross from Canada, who is an amazing women, works with women farmers. She also is part of La Via Campesina, the largest farmers movement in the world. And it's all about local organic farms. It's very connected to the Kickstarter campaign you're talking about, of really understanding how important our local organic food systems are and how they're part of climate solutions. So we really cut back on big agribusiness and their use in oil and how much carbon footprint they have and how important it is, especially also with extreme weather events, how much it's going to be so important to protect our food and our water and our local regions. So she's going to be doing a whole video on different local farmers and organic farming and why that's important to solutions. We have a very wonderful member in our organization who's from Congo, who's going to be working with pygmy women on how to protect the Congo forests. It's also one of our ongoing campaigns is around a campaign around women in forests and fossil fuel and mining resistance movements, because we're really seeing women on the front lines of protecting their forests all over the world and how it's affecting their way of life. So all of these actions will be posted on our website. There's going to be a gallery of all of these actions so people can learn about women and their solutions to climate change, but also the struggles that they're facing. So we're very, very excited about this and joining Eve Ensler in the 1 Billion Rising campaign. So that's sort of an immediate thing that's happened as a result of us all gathering last September.
Great things happen. Great things happen. And, you know, it's funny about the Kickstarter, because when our team decided to do it, it was not about the raising money piece. We tried to figure out what can we do to raise more awareness about Mrs. Green's World, about what you're doing, about having more people listen to the show. And when we, it's almost like reeling back the reel when you cast out, you know, when you're fishing. It was, we all eat, women prepare the food, we make purchases, we have the power, and what am I eating and why should I care? Coming up with, it all starts with your fork. It is about food security. It is about food safety. It is about the very health of us, ourselves, and our children. So we have to take a very short break, and we will be back. And when we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit more about the summit and the caucus, because there's still more to share about your pillars, and then talk about your amazing book, which was responsible for planting seeds in me and reconnecting uprisings for the earth. Everybody, please stay here with me. I am having the pleasure of interviewing Osprey Lake, and she is the founder of the Women's Earth and Climate Caucus and Summit. Please stay here with me. We'll be right back. Hi there, this is Mrs. Green with some pretty impressive news about the VW Jetta TDI. It's got a turbocharged clean diesel engine. It's 90% cleaner than previous diesel engines. It gets 609 miles on one tank of gas, more than the Prius. That's from Tucson, Arizona to San Diego and halfway back. And it's got an amazing 6-speed Tiptronic transmission. See Chapman VW today for a very special offer on the 2014 Jetta TDI or visit ChapmanTucson.com.
Bookman Sports Exchange is now open at 3330 East Speedway. We're taking our passion and experience of buying, selling, and trading books and music and applying it to the world of sporting goods, outdoor, and fitness gear. We are giving you another way to save money on the things that you love, Bookman style. Remember, Bookman Sports Exchange, sporting goods, outdoor, and fitness gear, now open daily from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. on Speedway east of Country Club. Check out bookmans.com for more info.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. I gave you the heads up at the first segment about fastening your seatbelt, because it is certainly a show that is giving us lots to think about today from someone who is truly dedicated to the preservation of this precious planet of ours on many, many fronts, nationally and internationally. Her name is Arielle Lake. She is an author. She is an artist. She is a thought leader and a truly a lifelong advocate of social and environmental justice issues. Arielle, thanks again, Osprey, for taking the time. Your middle name is Arielle, which we could talk about that too. Okay, let's go back to one of the things I always wanted to ask you is, in putting together this massive vision for a gathering of women that would then go back and become a part of this activated matrix for change and climate safety and all of that, how did you do it? How did you pick? Because everybody you picked, in my opinion, was a winner. How did you do that? How did you narrow it down to 100? Or just talk a little bit about the backstory.
Sure. Well, it was one of the most challenging tasks of putting together the summit. There's so many fabulous women leaders around the world. There's hundreds more that we could have had equally, you know, participating. So we did have an international steering committee. You know, I thought it was really important to not have it just be from a decision from someone from the U.S., but you know, really bringing in a group of international leaders to help make the decision. So that was very important. And, you know, the criteria really came down to, you know, making sure as many countries as we could be represented, and then also making sure the 8 issue areas that we were interested in focusing on, which we had selected in advance, could be well represented, areas that we felt were really cutting edge, so that we could have a very progressive conversation around climate change and climate solutions. So those are some of the key pieces. And then in terms of sort of the more well-known women, I mean, that's something that took a couple of years to, you know, really cultivate those relationships. One of the most key ones being with Dr. Vandana Shiva, who I was very fortunate, a colleague of mine, you know, had a relationship with her and introduced me to Vandana. And, you know, some of the early meetings I had about the summit really were in conversation with Vandana, and, you know, really wanted to make sure that she is such an important thought leader, an important voice in international affairs, that she thought it was a good idea, and sort of the whole concept of an integrated approach and how I was approaching it, you know, was in alignment with her. And you know, once we got the green light from her, I really felt that we could go forward. And then fortunately, I was at a conference where Dr. Jane Goodall was there and was able to have a conversation with her. And what I can tell you is that there was not one person who didn't instantly say yes. I mean, sometimes when you do things, especially with people who are well-known, you get turned down or, oh, I'll have my secretary call you, or, well, let's see. There was no one who hesitated on this, and that was thrilling. I mean, there's such a sense of women wanting to work together on this. You know, I hesitate to call climate change an issue because I really don't think it's an issue. I think it's a very serious condition and a result of how we've been living on the earth and with each other for a very long time. And we really need to treat it as something other than sort of an issue area. It's going to impact everybody in every which way possible of our lives as these extreme weather events continue. And I think we need to see it at a much deeper level because it's addressing not just climate, but every aspect about our lifestyle, our worldviews. I think something that women are really poised in position to do, whether you attribute it to our cultural upbringings or our biology, whatever you want to attribute to, I think we're in a really important place to talk about our inner values, our morals, and really make that stand. And that's what we're finding as, you know, I was collecting all the different women and inviting them to attend, is one thing we all have in common is just a fierce and ferocious understanding that we're fighting for future generations, we're fighting for the ecosystems of our mother planet. And the camaraderie and unity of that, of women collectively speaking out and saying, you know, enough is enough, we can't have business as usual, is something that I really sense amongst the women, even if they don't agree on exactly how we should work with corporations or not, and all these different other areas when you get into the nuances. The unity has been very, very strong about understanding that women must raise our voices. There's been movements in the past that have really affected us, like, you know, when we stopped nuclear testing in the United States. It was women around their kitchen tables who made that happen. The suffrage movement, the wonderful Chipko movement in India, where women stopped the forest from being cut down, the Liberian peace movement. We've seen these movements of women before, and we really think this is the time to do it, and that's really what, you know, brought the women together for the summit.
And you know what? What impressed me was there was an incredible sense of lack of ego in all the good things that that means. These are some of the most prominent global leaders, not just on issues of the environment, but in their research and in taking on corporations like Monsanto for food security. And there was just not entourages. Everybody was very approachable. And I, of course, have a bias. I think that has a lot to do with it being women. Let's just put it right out there. But that is one of the things that impressed me. It was, you could just go sit at a table wherever you were at the summit, and people wanted to engage in meaningful conversation. It was, you pulled that one off. It was great. Okay.
Oh, I'm so glad that you had that experience. Yeah.
It was unbelievable. Now, why is one of the pillars, I mean, I understand it, but I'd like you to answer the question. Why the rights of indigenous people? Why did you pick that out of one of many, many possibilities as one of your four pillars? Why is that so important to our planet?
Well, I think it's really important to understand that about 85% of the biodiversity, which is central to the whole DNA of life on our beautiful planet, is in the territories of indigenous peoples. 85% of what's left of our biodiversity is where indigenous people live. And a lot of that has to do with how they have their cosmovision of the world, their worldview and values, how they are in relationship with nature. That, I think, is absolutely essential to how we view how we're going forward. Of course, we're not going to be trying to go live in the forest again. I mean, people get so silly about that, like, oh, does that mean we're all going to go, you know, live out around campfires again, which actually might not be a bad idea. But that's not the point. The point is to learn from these indigenous worldviews and how we're going to translate them into a new cultural narrative, so that we are living in balance and harmony with nature again and respecting natural law. So I think, you know, one, we need to understand that indigenous rights are really important. We've, as a modern society, with colonialism all over the world, have really destroyed indigenous peoples all over the world, and they first of all, there's just an injustice there that we need to address, but also we need to really respect other ways of living and also understand how important it is to the very fabric of life. So I think Indigenous rights are really important. They've been ignored, abused, violated for hundreds and hundreds of years. So I think it's important not just for the case of Indigenous people, which is enough, just that they have their own rights and we should be respecting them and respecting the treaties that have been held with them, but also to understand, you know, that we have so much to learn from Indigenous people. So on every account, we think that it's very important that Indigenous rights are part of an overall framework. And I was mentioning earlier also, we think this goes hand in hand also with the rights of nature.
Right.
And I just returned about a week and a half ago from a really important conference in Ecuador, which I'm part of the Global Alliance for Rights of Nature, and I do the international advocacy for that organization. And we've been planning for about a two-year period now a Rights of Nature conference in Ecuador. And it was a phenomenal event where we had, again, people from all over the world who are really committing to rights of nature work. And we held it in Ecuador because Ecuador is the first country in the world that actually put rights of nature into their constitution. And this has been a really important law that it can also support Indigenous people in protecting their land. Unfortunately, since the rights of nature was put into the Constitution of Ecuador, there's the implementation and the government has not been respecting those laws. So there's a lot of conflict in that country right now. But in a nutshell, so people understand, I do believe that one of the most critical areas of work that we can focus on is the rights of nature, because it can truly address something around how we are having a relationship with the natural world. Pretty much around the world, almost all non-Indigenous systems of law, nature is treated and ecosystems are treated as property and as commerce, and that's been a huge problem of why we're in so many environmental crises. So, you know, our life-giving rivers, our forests, our mountains are treated as property to be sold and consumed. And as property, these natural communities, these ecosystems that we are dependent upon, are not recognized as right holders. And so in our legal systems, because nature's property, it really doesn't have a standing in court. And these new environmental laws that we're talking about, the rights of nature laws, are very powerful because it says trees have standing in a court of law, rivers have standing, so that we can really begin to see a very different legal framework that can really restore our natural communities. So as an example, you know, communities who are facing fracking. Right now, communities don't have a, you know, it's very difficult to fight corporations and state law that says fracking is going to happen in your community. So when you combine rights of nature laws and community rights, which are very, very important to a community being able to stand up and say we don't want fracking in our community, and there's a wonderful organization in the United States, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDEF, that really offers communities a way to write ordinances to say what they want in their community when harms come. So it's a whole different view on how we need to look at environmental law. And so this conference we were holding in Ecuador was to really talk to people all over the world who are involved in community rights, rights of nature laws at the local level, but also at the national and international level, and how we can have a completely different framework that really respects Mother Earth, respects natural law, and puts the hands of law back into communities where they can defend their ecosystems.
You know, what I think that you do so successfully is one of my frustrations at times. I call it integrated thought because it really is one planet, and what happens in Ecuador has an immediate and dramatic impact on the very air that I breathe. Part of why I understand that is because I went to the Amazon and I started to awaken the dreamer in me, literally, about the importance of the preservation of this vast piece of nature that gives us the very air we breathe. What are some of the forces that are knocking that down? And my husband has a way, he says, if it's not about the money, it's about the money. And is it the oil companies? I know Ecuador has what I would call, you know, backpedaled a bit on their stand as environmental leaders in the preservation of the rainforest. What's your spin on that from the very, very many connections you get to make on a regular basis?
Well, it is about the money, and why we need to change not just our legal constructs in relationship to nature,
right,
but also our worldviews, because you really need a cultural change about our values, what we value, what we don't value, and our relationship to nature, as well as our governance structure. So it's a really, again, as we're talking about, deep systemic change around capitalism, around patriarchy, around our view that we have dominion over nature, our views about equality and financing, you name it. I mean, we are in a major transformation as a civilization, and it gets played out, unfortunately, in the most brutal ways in a lot of these communities that have actually not been having a big carbon footprint,
right,
and have not been polluting, which is really also another part of the tragedy. So in Ecuador, there was, you know, some really powerful initiatives like Rights of Nature in the Constitution. There was also the Yasuni ITT initiative, which was a really bold and wonderful vision by the Correa and his administration and the National Assembly there to protect Yasuni, which is this probably one of the most biodiverse places on the entire planet. It's an incredibly beautiful, pristine region of the Amazon forest in Ecuador, and the original idea was to preserve this park by having the international community give funds to Ecuador to not drill oil and to protect the park, and that was the initiative that was put out to say, you know, we will protect this if the international community, you know, it gives us the exchange
right.
of funds that we would get for drilling. It's very complex and too much time for this show right now, but it did not work out for a variety of reasons. And so, and unfortunately, the setup doesn't work because if, you know, you don't give money for the drilling, then the outcome is, okay, then we will drill. So the setup from the beginning probably wasn't such a great idea, which is why we think Rights of Nature is a much better solution, which is to not harm ecosystems in the first place. But that said, there's been a real backing down on the Yasuni ITT initiative and the Rights of Nature work in Ecuador so that the different areas of the forest can be auctioned off for oil. And that's the process that's going on right now, and it's sort of being framed that either, you know, we can have poverty in Ecuador or we can have, you know, good health care, good education, good jobs, but that will mean we need to drill for the oil to get the money.
Right.
And so these are the kinds of equations that we see not just in Ecuador, but, you know, all over the world where these false solutions and false choices are being offered that you have to destroy the planet so we can live well. And that whole paradigm absolutely is so destructive, and it has to end. And it's set up by corporations. It's set up by our current economic and governance structures, and that's why we keep, you know, advocating for system change, because the system has to change, because the powers that be are going to continue this old market-based model that is what's exactly destroying the earth. So it's a
and
very
it
difficult...
isn't true. It's like you said, it's
no, it's
big...
not true, and it's also very difficult in Ecuador right now because they're also starting to unfortunately criminalize the defenders of the land, the defenders of the earth, the defenders of rights of nature. So on top of it all, when you begin to silence people and take away their democratic freedom to speak out on alternatives and defend the things that, like nature and their way of life, it becomes even more complicated. And so we also are very much standing with our allies in Ecuador to support them in this very difficult time.
And there's hope. There's really hope. And we're going to have to take another break. It seems like that was about a 3-minute segment. When we come back, I'd really like to talk about your book, Uprisings for the Earth, and bring our audience on a little bit of the deeper journey, because to me, at the end of the day, it is about the real connection with nature. And there's such an investment for us and our children and our grandchildren. So let's go a little bit about the deeper journey and how your journey as such a vocal advocate for Mother Earth began. I think that's an important piece of this, because if it is to be, like I said, it's up to me. And you're starting to connect big, big, big green dots on behalf of the planet. So does that sound like a good plan for the next segment?
Sure. Absolutely.
Okay. Everybody, in case you just tuned in, I have as my guest Osprey Ariel Lake. She is an artist, an advocate for the Earth, and head of the Women's Earth and Climate Caucus and Summit. Stay here with me.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Mrs. Green's World is a proud member of the Dream Vision 7 and Glimmerglass Radio Networks. If you have questions about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World next.
Think blue. Think beyond green. Think TDI clean diesel technology. One part of the Volkswagen Think Blue initiative, our goal of creating and encouraging eco-conscious products and behaviors. This is Mrs. Green. A car that can drive a long way should still make you want to, well, drive a long way. Volkswagen Jetta's TDI clean diesel is a high-mileage vehicle that lets you stop at the filling station less often so you can spend more time enjoying the road. See Chapman VW today for a very special offer on the 2014 Jetta TDI.
Did you know that even a donated doorknob can help Habitat for Humanity? Habitat's Habastore accepts donated items like furniture, building materials, and appliances. Donations come from commercial builders, malls, restaurants, hotels, and individuals like you. Then, items are bought by bargain hunters who come across the very things they are looking for, just like the right doorknob. The best part is that Habastore sales generate funds for building homes. Call 520-889-7200 or visit HabitatTucson.org.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to, and we are certainly being given the gift of lots to think about today from someone who is dedicated to the preservation of this planet of ours on every level and on many fronts. Her name is Osprey Lake. She is an author, an artist, which we have to do a show about that, because you never really talk about what an artist you are, Osprey. She is the founder and president of the Women's Earth and Climate Caucus and is co-chair of the International Advocacy for Global Alliance for the Rights of Nature. I mean, this is a big, big mission that you have said yes to, my friend. So let's talk a little bit about how the journey began with you. And, you know, the truth is, it's your show and your message, and I'm the messenger of, you know, I'm the conduit. So if that's a perfect segue for you, it's a perfect segue for me, but it's really a conversation. So if there are points that I haven't hit, let her rip.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much for all of your work as well. Well, I think for like a lot of us, you know, and I wrote this a lot in my, you know, different parts of this in my book, Uprisings for the Earth, Reconnecting Culture with Nature, that I think a lot of people I've talked to as well who are engaged in different work about caring for our planet and making change and is starting when we were very young. I mean, for me, this starts, you know, when I was, you know, early on. I grew up in a beautiful town called Mendocino, which is just 4 hours north of San Francisco on the coast of California, with beautiful, beautiful redwood trees. And just the beauty of the land was astonishing, and it was such a privilege to grow up there. In fact, I still go there often. I still consider it a home, even though I don't live there full time. And, you know, there's something about the beauty and awe and wonder of the natural world that when it's deeply embedded in you, you never forget it. It's part and particle of who we are. We are nature. And when, you know, you live with that and then begin to learn, as I did through my high school years, about the destruction of the land, you know, in our area at the time, you know, some of the big issues were around the redwood forests and the cutting of the last of the redwood trees, which, for, you know, most people know what they are, but, you know, they're the largest trees in the world. They're absolutely magnificent beings. And, you know, for me, that was just very heartbreaking to spend so much time as a child in the redwood forest and then begin to get educated about, you know, what was going on with them and really the destruction of the forests. And I began to get engaged in campaigns to protect the forests in my region. And that really started me understanding that, you know, while we lived on this incredibly beautiful planet with so much diversity and so much to learn from nature, that, you know, just through a cascading series of events, you know, we were really, you know, polluting and destroying the thing that I loved the most. So that is has been a big inspiration to me all my life, as well as early on I had the opportunity to meet Indigenous peoples who I've spent a lot of time with and have had a lot of influence from, understanding from their worldview a deep connection with nature and, you know, very brilliant philosophies of that are very different than our modern understanding of the natural world. And those things really influenced me and, you know, really made me very determined, like many people, to do everything I could to protect the earth and our future generations.
So when you talk about, let's kind of reel it back a little bit. When you talk about your journey, Uprisings for the Earth, writing a very significant book, and people, you can get it on Amazon.com. It is not a hard-to-read book, and what I mean by that is you just want to keep turning the page and finding out more about what Osprey has to say. And I really don't say that to just flatter you. It really did have a profound effect on me, and you could tell from the first time we got on the phone. But what about people that are listening, and we have listeners from all over the world that might be saying, that's great. She does all these wonderful things. I agree with it. Mrs. Green started a radio show. What can I do? I live in Cincinnati. You know, I live in New Zealand. I have people that listen to me in Australia. What can I do? I go to work 8 to 5. How can I show up on the planet and make a difference in the world that I impact every day?
That's a good question. And, you know, I think, you know, many, you know, thought leaders will tell you this in different ways. And so I don't mean this tritely at all. I truly have experienced and work with people all over the world on a daily basis. I think it really is important to understand, you know, as we say, everyone does make a difference. It turns out it's really true. And that, you know, I think it can be very misleading to think that, you know, sort of the superstars are the ones doing it all, and, you know, the woman who's living in her home and recycling doesn't count. I think that that's totally untrue. I have seen amazing things happen from small seeds of actions that people make in their own lives. And I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, one, getting really educated, just finding out what is going on in my community,
right.
What is the health of my community, where does my water come from, where does my food come from, what are the issue areas in my community to protect the ecosystem and to protect my community, and then from there, you know, not getting overwhelmed with that, just getting, you know, finding out what groups are in your community. But I think the second part is really finding out what draws you, because, you know, this work is really very, let's say, it can become overwhelming.
Yes.
It's also something that can be very exciting. So I think it's also very important to understand what is in alignment with me, what is in alignment with you, what is it that we're really attracted to, because then we're going to be joyful in the work that we do. And that's really important, even though there's so much hardship going on in the world and so much devastation. You know, it's important to live our lives and enjoy our lives and enjoy our family, enjoy our friends, and enjoy our colleagues, and have passion about the work that we do and have joy in doing it. So I think it's really important to also really find out what it is that we're most attracted to doing and follow that path. We can't do it all, so find the thing that we love to do. And, you know, I even have, you know, women who who are connected in our network, and the one thing they do is they, have their own home garden, and they are educating their children around, how to garden and what it means to eat really good food. And they think, oh, that's just such a small task. And, I don't think it is at all. Those are the future generations who are now getting a very different model of what it means to eat and how to grow their own food, how to care for themselves, how to be healthy, how to care for their environment. I think that's huge. And we should not see any of these things as small tasks, but really value all of them. So it can be teaching your children about a garden and what it means to have good food to, taking on a cause in your region. I think that there's so much to do that any entry point that someone has passion about is of great value.
And I think that what encourages me is there are now, I write this on my Facebook page, I'm signing a lot of petitions these days, and it really does feel like I'm participating. And they're making a difference. They're making a difference in Congress. They're making a difference globally. Because if someone sees 100,000 signatures show up in 3 days, they know there's more to that. I like to reference the non-GMO Cheerios. As trite as that may seem, it's very significant because they got the message from a very small Facebook post, and it went nuts because people said, let's have non-GMO Cheerios. So finding your voice and believing that you have the ability to show up and make a difference, I think that's the core of what you got in touch with for Uprisings for the Earth and that reconnecting. We have the power. We have the big message. That's how I feel. There are companies that have the big bucks, but we do have the big message and the big power. Okay, let's talk about the calls to action that you would say on your level are some of the most important areas for people to look at. I agree with you that what we eat, I mean, obviously, the Kickstarter thing, it was a very well thought out campaign because it does start with your fork. It's something we all have in common. What are some of the other biggies on your screen and for the international connection of women? You talked about violence. I mean, that's actually all part of it, because as long as women are getting abused, we don't have a sustainable planet. So talk a little bit about that view.
I think the areas that, that I find to be really promising and really putting us in a progressive direction that we need to go. I think that the rights of nature work is very, very important, as I mentioned, and we have a website called the Global Alliance for Rights of Nature, and people can learn about that, and also with that, community rights and how communities can have a say about what's happening in their communities and how to write local ordinances to protect their communities using community rights and rights of nature laws. I think we need new governance that is based on nature, and we need new economic structures that are based on nature and our Earth's carrying capacity. I think it's key that we move to understanding the natural laws of our Earth, and rights of nature can do that. So I think that's a very big focus and something for people to learn about. And there's on that site, there's also a petition you can sign called the Universal Declaration of the Rights of Mother Earth that we could get a lot more signatures on that would help us push that through to the UN level and others. So that's one really important transformative campaign. I think another one is the Citizens Climate Lobby. I think they're doing incredible work to get a price on carbon pollution in the United States. And this is something that we're very focused on, not just in the U.S. as the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network, but in other countries as well. It was part of our one of the working groups at our summit, and this year we're going to be looking much more into that, but people can learn about that at Citizens Climate Lobby at their website, and really how getting a price on carbon is one of the key components we see that will move the markets towards clean energy economy around solar and wind and geothermal technologies, and we need a way to get the money to go in the right direction, and putting a price on carbon will really help do that. We need to get the money out of the fossil fuel industry and into solar and wind and these other technologies. So Citizens Climate Lobby, I think, is doing a great job. I think another big important campaign is, there's some divestment campaigns, but there's also some divest and invest campaigns. all these campaigns around divesting from the fossil fuel industry, I think, are stellar, and we need to really focus on them. And then, of course, you know, tooting our own horn here, we would really encourage people to go to our website at wecaninternational.org and look at our projects and campaigns that we're working on, from women in forest and fossil fuel resistance to signing our declaration. Also, we have an online solutions forum, which has been very successful, where all of your listeners and anyone can go and join the online solutions forum, and you can upload the actions you're involved in, the projects, campaigns, or policies you're involved in, and then our network all over the world will be able to engage with you and get connected in. So we really welcome people to join the online solutions forum. And so these are some of the things that I think are really, really essential. And as we talked about, you know, this fight with the GMOs and really protecting our food shed, I think, is really important. And those are the areas that we think are really key and something everyone can engage in. Every one of the things I said, the doors are wide open for participation.
And there's something for everyone. And I think what you said earlier in the show about find what it is that brings you joy, that brings you satisfaction, something that you can be behind. You know, it can be as simple and as important as changing ordinances that allow chicken coops. I mean, having your own chickens is a really good thing for kids and for eating healthy eggs and for, you know, the whole circle of life that that impacts. And I had someone email me the other day from within Arizona, and we are certainly not the thought leaders in many areas, to put it mildly. Arizona has a reputation, but not for that. There are incredibly wonderful things going on in our state in terms of supporting local farmers and local businesses and organic farms. But one of these emails I got was from a woman who said, my HOA is not letting me put solar on the roof of our home in the neighborhood. And there's a statute. I mean, even Arizona has a statute that says HOAs cannot forbid you or prohibit you from putting solar on your roofs. And I'm like, how happy would we be if we went into a community and saw solar on every roof? It should bring people joy. So it is that part that you say, find your sweet spot for climate action. There's a lot at stake, a real lot at stake. And I don't think you're self-promoting at all. I want everybody to be part of this. And going back to the summit, it wasn't just those 100 women. You had media from all over the world, but you had international feeds. So people were able to participate in the conversation from around the globe. And that was very exciting to be in the room and know that there were women from all over the world that were engaged in this big vision that you and the other founders have had.
Yeah, no, it was very exciting. We had over 550 what we called vision hubs or watch parties.
So exciting.
From 65 countries. And it was, as you said, just thrilling to have all that participation from around the world. And just for your men listeners to know as well, there's a lot of men engaged in our group as too. It's not just for women. We are lifting up women's leadership because we think it's very important to, for all the reasons we said earlier in the show. But it's been very exciting to have a lot of men also sign our declaration, fund our work, support our work, and understand that women's leadership is key to everyone. It benefits boys, men, women, girls, the ecosystems. It's just been a really important time to understand how important women's leadership is for everyone.
And the January issue of National Geographic, how timely was it for me that it was about the Amazon and about the tribes that are really uniting, tribes that were killing each other 50 years ago, literally, that are uniting men and women to have their voice be heard about our very precious, you know, the Amazon rainforest. It's unbelievable. So the really sad thing is that the show is about to end. We have about 1 minute. And thank you so much, not just for being on the show, but for the big yes that you have embraced and helped to, you know, mobilize people from around the globe for on behalf of Mother Earth, because that's your big yes, I'm sure. Next week, everybody, it's very appropriate. We didn't even plan it this way, but it's a woman named Lorraine Lee Wondrowski, and she's an attorney. She's an owner of a small farm in upstate New York. She's a very vocal advocate on Twitter for small farms across the United States. Believe me, she'll give us lots to think about in terms of why we need to keep farming local. You want to join us. Osprey Lake, thank you for your presence on the planet. Everybody, make it a great green week.
Thank you.